Welcome to another segment of the Gabe Archive Show, where we explore gay history one bar at a time. I'm your host, Art Smith, and today's segment is a departure from our usual format of discussing the gay bars we loved and lost. After the life-altering impact of COVID-19 pandemic, we have had to say goodbye to countless gay bars that have served us for decades. Some have even suggested that the gay bar scene was withering away. Enter Frankie Sharp. This highly acclaimed and remarkably accomplished New York City nightlife promoter and producer has assembled a star-studded team of partners and investors to prove the doomsday prophets wrong. Today's episode is about the newest, hottest club to hit the New York scene since Studio 54. So welcome to the show, Frankie.
Oh, thanks so much. How are you? I'm so happy to be here. I'm actually shocked I'm on time because I was running from the venue, as I always do now that I live there every single moment of my life. So right. I'm happy to be here and on time.
That's the hidden space you don't talk about, right? Frankie's bedroom.
Right, that's exactly right, right. Not so hidden, but sure.
So you've been around the gay scene for a little while. Which defunct gay club had the biggest impact on you and your career path?
I guess that's sort of twofold, right? So before I moved to New York, I was a big New York file. So I was really obsessed with old New York. And old New York to me was the 90s and early 2000s. So it was Limelight. It was the club kids scene. Then it, you know, bled into Suzanne Barr. So I was really obsessed with that whole colorful scene as a young queer kid growing up in San Francisco. And when I moved to New York finally, there wasn't too many places that still had that essence, which was a kind of multi-level, multicultural, multi-generational, multi-soundscape event other than Mr. Black. When I moved to New York, my first roommate was DJ Michael Magnin, and so I was essentially his groupie for the first few months that I lived here. And so I went to every gig with him, and I was out with him until 5-6 in the morning when I had to be at work at 9 in the morning. But it was Mr. Black. It really, really changed the trajectory of what my nightlife existence was.
Yeah, how would you describe Mr. Black, to someone who's never been there, how would you describe it? What kind of energy? What kind of vibe?
Well, from what I can remember, because, I was pretty much three sheets to the wind for the most part from my experience there. But what I remember of it, it was really magical and very sexy and very colorful and very, didn't take itself too seriously. So I remember there being three individual rooms, and the main room had a huge dance floor space that had a crystal chandelier. So it felt really opulent. And the opulence was really juxtaposed by kind of filthy, thick house music. And it just, I love the idea of juxtapositions, of taking something high end and low end or filthy and immaculate and meeting in the middle and creating a sort of a chemical reaction. And that's what Mr. Black felt like, both in its the people that were there as artists and performers and DJs and the people that went there. So you had house music, hip hop, trip hop, electro, and then you had, you know, Sophia Lamar on the microphone and Amanda Lepore posing in the corner and all of these just great, bigger, larger than life personalities that most of us, I think, moved to New York for. I think we were all looking for our tribe, and I think that was the first time I realized I found them, and my tribe being just New York City nightlife.
Now, when you mentioned Mr. Black to me earlier, I went and did a little bit of research on it because I didn't know anything about it. And I ran across an article. I don't know if you're familiar with this or not, but this was in 2007. The Village Voice ran an article about something that happened at Mr. Black. And this is the way the article starts. The staff at Mr. Black, a gay dance club located on Broadway and Bleecker, spent Labor Day weekend in lockdown where well-known DJ Sammy Joe of Sisters fame shared cell space with alleged hotel murderer Clarence Dean, while some of the club's better-known characters, a.k.a. The Ass and Mini Ass, measured out the hours in the cell next over. Apparently, Labor Day weekend of 2007, about 30 or 40 police converged on the bar, including a few undercover policemen in drag. They were from the Manhattan South Narcotics Squad, and they busted the bar and arrested 17 people, including two employees, one that was known as the Ass, who was a cocktail server who went bottomless, and also a go-go boy named Chase Hostler, who was known as Mini Ass. So, does that kind of encapsulate the something you would expect to happen there? Have a bottomless server coming around bringing cocktails and a...
Yeah, I mean, the bottomless server is funny because now that person lives in LA and owns a venue of their own, which is really funny. But the Ass was a server for the VIP sections who only wore an apron and no underwear. And he was called the Ass because he had quite an exceptional one. So he was another sexy component personality of the Mr. Black crew and family, which was, again, part of that sexy, seedy vibe that was just so in your face that it then was so beyond that it translated into something really glamorous and surreal. In terms of them going to jail, I mean, those kids, the kids in nightlife are trouble, and that, you know, so much of the people that go out and participate in nightlife are looking for that intoxicating feeling. And I know those kids to have fun. I can't speak on anything that happened that night. That 2007 was way before my time, but I'm not surprised. They're crazy kids.
Now you hit the New York club scene as a resident a couple years later, right?
September 11th, 2009 is when I took a one-way ticket to New York and never looked back.
Excellent. From what I've read, among your most memorable nightlife events in the Big Apple was something called West Gay at the Westway Club. Mm-hmm. One article even described you as, quote, the beacon of New York nightlife, currently shining brighter and more fabulously than all the rest. And they went on to proclaim that you, quote, have transformed the city's gay scene with an injection of hardcore glamour and killer music. Does that kind of speak to what you did at West Gay? And
I'd like to believe so. I mean, when I moved here and Mr. Black was kind of tapering out and I was deciding what to do with my life in New York and what my role here was, and it really just kind of organically moved into producing nightlife events. And a lot of it was because after Mr. Black, I thought there was a void. So I started a party in the Lower East Side, which was a really small, kind of smaller version of West Gay. And then the owners of the Westway reached out to me because of the success of that small party. And that's when I opened West Gay. And West Gay to me was just, my approach was everything in the kitchen sink and just lay it on thick. And also it was my opportunity to take a lot of my California, San Francisco ideology or mentality from the nightlife there, which was diverse in so many different performance artists, drag queens, again, DJs, artists, all in one room, instead of segregating them by, you know, it wasn't a separation of classes or race or gender or anything like that. It was everyone all together. So that was really important to me. And in that, in the Westway was a dilapidated strip club that the owners of the Westway bought, really didn't change a thing except for the sound system. So the whole thing was kind of falling apart as we were in there tearing it apart. But the people that were there were stylists and celebrities and models and pop stars and rappers and the kids on the street and the kids who went to FIT. And so it was just a really beautiful mix of, again, that sort of high-low, filthy, immaculate spectrum of brilliant New Yorkers. And so it was a place for all of us to go and just feel the fantasy. And I'm really proud to say that was just one of the most magical moments of my life. And it changed my life because it really allowed me to see what I can do and what I really love, which at the end of the day, as cheesy as it may sound, I'm a community builder. And so I was able to do that there. And everything about West Gay was beautiful and fucked up and just super, super, super fun.
Yeah, I've stumbled across quite a number of of pictures and flyers from West Gay through my research. And mm-hmm. I'm going to be posting some of them over this video so people can kind of get a feel for it.
There's some of them are censored.
But it looks like a lot of fun. It looks like it was just everybody was enjoying themselves. It had some great energy. You know, the logo, the only logo I found for it was on a neon sign, which is really cool in and of itself.
Yeah, we really didn't actually have a logo. What was also great about Westgate was it was my first foray really into the production end of nightlife. So every single flyer that you may have saw, I did it myself. And I had no idea how to use Illustrator or Photoshop. I just taught myself. So if you actually go through the timeline, or if you go through the flyers chronologically, the first one is very questionable. And they get better with time because it was just all trial and error throughout the years. But yeah, the logo was never the same because the flyer was always a different thing. It looked like, you know, a cover of a cereal box to you know, a dry cleaning receipt to a Craigslist ad. They all looked very, very different. And the only thing that was sort of the main branding was the pink neon sign that I bought for $400 in Chinatown that sat in the middle of the room, but it ended up being the heartbeat the heart of the space. And it became pretty iconic just in its like simple typography, a pink hue, and in the middle of everything.
And so, then of course there's the memorable female torso disco ball.
And which I tried to get closing night, but someone snatched it. I don't know who did, but someone's got it. Someone's got it out there. But yeah, that was a really special one too. That was photographed quite a bit from people.
Yeah, and I'm sure as soon as you see it, you know where it was.
Yeah, exactly.
So what is your most memorable experience personally at West Gay?
The first time I booked a really big, one of the greatest things about West Gay was it was my chance to get a little selfish and book people that I was in awe of and in love with since I was a kid. So Lady Miss Keir from Delight DJed the very opening party of West Gay. And then, but who opened for her was my two best friends who were a part of this rap group called House of LaDosha. So I was able to blend my family, my nightlife chosen family, with this icon that I loved since I was a teenager. And that was really beautiful to me. And I kind of kept that formula or vibe going where I was able to just hire the icons and people that I love. So when I was able to hire Lil Kim for the first time, when she finally showed up and performed, which I don't even remember how it all happened. I think I just maybe emailed her stylist or something like on Facebook or whatever the platform was back then. When she performed, it was, you know, like 800, 900 people or whatever the Westway fit. The air conditioner broke. It was in the middle of July and everyone was sweating, but they were so excited that Lil Kim was in the room with us rapping. And I remember me and my assistant were weeping out of pure joy, but it was great because no one could tell because we were also sweating bullets. And that was a really amazing, amazing time. And then since then we had so many other performers like Azealia Banks and Foxy Brown and, you know, local performers like Hercules and Love Affair, and half of the Scissor Sisters came to perform, and that's how I met Jake Shears, who later became one of my friends and investors in this project coming up. And the whole thing was just a magical, cosmically put together, magnificent experience. Every moment had a really strong hold on my heart. So it's hard to pick one, but it all was incredible.
Well, it sounds like it was. I'm sorry I wasn't up there at that time. but I'm sure now that you're opening Q, you'll be able to, you know, bring in that kind of energy and vibe and redo it on a different level.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah.
So you were once quoted as saying, "I want to have a party that turns into a show that turns back into a party. What if I did a party that had Bjork, then RuPaul, and after that, a marching band? Why does the night have to end?" Does that have any relevance to your vision for Q?
Weirdly, I remember that quote. I think it was either from the Times or the Village Voice. I forget. But I remember saying that. And I remember that being a sort of, a vision and a thought for the future. Really, truly, it was a true quote that I really believed, and something that I wanted to strive for. And weirdly, without getting too emotional, I'm realizing a lot of that is manifesting itself into this new project. And, you know, because since that quote, I've worked with Bjork, you know, obviously worked with RuPaul and the girls from Drag Race. And I have a big band, had a big band at Club Coming with my cabaret. And I have a big band that's an in-house big band with my cabaret floor at the Q. So in a strange way, it is all happening. So it's interesting to hear that quote when I haven't heard it probably in like 7 or 8 years, because it's a key part of what I'm doing today. So interesting. That's amazing.
Yeah, and that's part of the reason I'm doing this project, is because even the people that were involved, even you, having said that, 7 years later, don't really remember it clearly. But people who just heard it or visited or experienced part of it, their memories start to fade after a while. And, you know, over the course of the past year and a half, I've documented over 1,300 gay bars that used to exist at one point in time and are no longer around. And that's only the tip of the iceberg. Right. I mean, there's, I'm sure, thousands more that I will continue to find as I move along. So speaking of the Q, as I mentioned in the open, you have assembled a stellar cast of players to work with you on bringing this new concept of the Q to life. And I'm going to mention the names of each of your partners and investors, and I want you to talk a little bit about what they're going to bring to the table and what their take is on this project. Let's start off with Alan Pikus.
Alan Pikus, this was Alan Pikus's idea from the get-go, which is interesting. Him and I really hadn't worked together before this partnership, and it was an intuitive connection that we had from the beginning, and really was a phone call that called me up and he asked me, you know, we've met a couple of times. Your track record speaks for itself. I'm looking to open a new venue in Manhattan. And this is back in 2019, I think in the spring of 2019. And me and my business partner, Bob Fluitt from Boxers, and building and construction and architecture, that's what his main business is outside from Boxers, are looking for a creative partner to open a new space. Have you ever thought about opening your own club? Sort of without even thinking about it or even vetting them, I just said yes. And I oftentimes work intuitively and by energy, and it just came to be. And also, when I really did think about what that kind of marriage could be, because that's essentially what it is when you have these business partnerships, Alan Pikus is a brilliant producer and promoter, and his strong hold is on uptown Hell's Kitchen, Chelsea crowd, where mine is downtown Brooklyn and the surrounding boroughs, and you know, everything that I had done for the last 10 years in different instances, including cabaret and live music. So I thought, with combining our forces and frankly our mailing lists, to fill a room would be not only not difficult, but it would be one of the most diverse rooms that New York had ever seen. So that seemed like a no-brainer. And that's been and remains to be our approach when it comes to programming and who we want in the room. So I just felt like I had a very strong partner in him.
Yeah, I've heard about some of his events and his rooftop parties and things like that. And it's definitely impressive. Now, you also mentioned Bob Fluitt, and he owns the Boxers in Manhattan, as well as being in construction and architecture. So obviously he brought a different skill set to the table. And I heard you say in one interview that pretty much everything that you or Alan dreamed up and kind of threw on the table, he said, yeah, I can build that.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah.
So what kind of architectural features can we expect to find there that Bob has put in to, you know, without giving the whole thing away, but what kind of the memorable things are people going to see when they walk in the door and go, wow, this is cool?
Yeah. Yeah. I'll have to think about what I can give away without giving too much away. But I know on the, so at this point in time, the cat's a little bit out of the bag of what we're doing. The first floor is a classic 1950s, 60s Copacabana, Goodfellas cabaret, and you know, tufted bankheads and beautiful curtain drapery, black and white diamond floor, a gold bar. But in that, we have so many platforms. I really wanted to make the space immersive and not just a sort of one note, no pun intended, cabaret bar. So in that space, there's multiple platforms for performers to be. There's multiple apparatuses, if you will, that dancers and performers can swing from. There's lots of layers that were part of my dreamscape that I just asked Bob, can we build this? Is that crazy? And he would just do it and figure out a way to do it without question most of the time. But as a business person, actually, the only question he asked was, if I build this weird thing for you, is that going to build me revenue? So he also taught me a lot about our bottom line and how to look out for those things. When we go through the second and third floor, we have a cruisy kind of labyrinthy lounge on the second floor, as well as a 3,000 square foot nightclub on the third floor with 22 foot ceiling heights. And on that club floor, there's a caged catwalk and a beautiful lounge with suspended chandeliers and a bunch of other things that can't really give too much away. But again, it's just more beautiful things that I always wanted when I started manifesting this project that he built. In fact, everything is now being finished. And just the other day, I was walking through this space, and it was the first time really that I allowed myself to kind of process this whole thing. And seeing all of these things come into fruition, I just fully wept. I just was really taken back by all the work that all three of us had done on this. And I just couldn't believe it. It's my dream club, my dream venue. It's amazing.
And if you had that reaction, you know, without it being packed with patrons, without the laser lights on, without the music pounding, imagine what people who have not seen the space at all are going to think, you know, the first time they walk in there and they have all those elements going on with it. I mean, if it's blowing you away after you've been looking at it for a year in progress, I think we're in for a really big treat with this club.
I hope so. I really hope so. I really wanted to give something for everyone. And, you know, I've said this before, but it's a really good way for me to explain what we're doing there, which is, you know, both Alan and I have produced, you know, 1,000-person raves and club nights with hundreds of people. And I've DJed at the Cock until 4 or 5 in the morning, and I've created and produced beautiful live music shows and cabarets. And so this was my chance to make a brick and mortar sort of multiplex for all of those things. And so it kind of gives no one a reason to leave once they're there. And, or if they don't want to, you know, see a show with a screaming drag queen with a piano, they can go upstairs and make out with a stranger, or they can go upstairs and dance the night away. It's just everything, 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 everything.
That sounds pretty cool. Now, Alan and Bob have been with you since this project kind of actually started going. Mm-hmm. But now that you've gotten underway, you recently announced that you have a number of celebrity investors that have come into the picture as well. And so let's start with the one that I think is just amazing. I mean, he could be the cover boy or cover girl for the club's ads almost. Billy Porter, he made such a statement on the red carpet, just coming out in that elaborate gown. And that's the kind of personality I get. I think you're trying to, you know, embrace with this concept is, you know, somebody like Billy Porter, and here he is right at your door saying, here's some money, I want to be involved. What did he have to say about the project when you first spoke with him?
Me and Billy Porter are family. He's very, very close to my partner, my boyfriend, and we've known each other now for years. They've known each other for years. I've known Billy and gotten very close to him over the last 6 years. Next month is me and my partner's 6-year anniversary. I just had to remember that. But he has been watching. He's been watching my growth and my career, and has also been present in there for this entire year and a half project. When I announced the investorship, it was only shortly before that he agreed to do it, and I was teetering on even asking him to do so, because it's always funny to mix friendship and money. It's a sticky situation. But weirdly, Bob said, should we talk about some strategic investors, i.e. should you call some of your famous friends? So I just thought right away, Billy Porter, because to echo everything you just said about it, he is the epitome and the almost exact identity of the kinds of the brave new world that should have been the world the whole time that we're creating, which is our ethos. And it was a no-brainer. So I called him up. I said, you know, I'm opening this club. I really could use your help. What do you think? And without even a second, he said, sure, I'd love to talk. We scheduled a walkthrough. He saw the space. Within minutes, he was like, I got your back. And that was it. And then that sort of just inspired me to call up Jake Shears, who was a friend of mine for decades at this point. And so I called him up, and it was the same thing. And then he thought, should we call up some other people? And so then we started reaching out to Zachary Quinto and Charlie Carver, all people that I met on the dance floor. And really, without a beat, they all just said they'd love to support me and my partners and what we're doing. And gratitude for those people doesn't even touch on what I actually feel. It's amazing. I'm incredibly fortunate.
And I think another aspect that they will bring to the picture is that, you know, when you think about the heyday of clubs in New York, like Limelight that you mentioned earlier, Studio 54, they're always involved with some key celebrities that were there, people that everybody recognized and knew. And it was kind of an additional draw. I'm going to go there, and maybe I'm going to see Liza Minnelli at Studio 54 or whatever. And you've got, you know, with Charlie Carver, Billy Porter, Jake Shears, Zachary Quinto. You've got an interesting cross section there. And then you add in the partners, you know, yourself and Alan and Bob. And you've got like a United Nations of gay men, you know. You've got all kinds of nationalities represented. You've got, you know, black, white, Hispanic, Asian. You got everything in there. And it's really kind of a great blend that I think speaks to, from what I understand, has always been your philosophy about the bar scene. It shouldn't be exclusive. This is not the kind of place where you're going to have a doorman telling people, no, you can't come in because you're too black or you're too fat or you're too, you know, scrappy or whatever.
Or whatever. That sounds just insane. Right. Yeah. Of course. You know,
which is really amazing. Now, one thing you did not mention, and I thought was, because, you know, I came out in the gay club scene, in the late 70s. So I have a little bit different perspective than you do as far as what the first 10 or 15 years of my gay party life were like. But I heard a mention that one of the things you're planning on doing at the Q is something that I dearly miss and haven't seen in a long time. And that's a Sunday tea dance. Is that actually going to be a reality?
Oh my God. Of course. I mean, if not Manhattan, my favorite place on the planet is Fire Island. And the Sunday teas, or the Saturday and Sunday teas, rather. So they do that on Friday, too? I think they do. But those changed my life, specifically Lena T on Sundays with DJ Lena Bradford. And that magical moment that was captured by her and her insane sorcery and sonic ability to spread love through that crowd was life-changing, truly. And in that, she became a very close friend and almost a mentor, too, in love and art. And it was very important for me to take that feeling and bring it to the Q if I could. And, you know, Lena will be there every other Sunday, every once in a while. Can't have her on residency, unfortunately, because she's getting busier and busier because she's getting more and more attention and appreciated and love. But yes, a tea dance is where it's at. It's always soulful. It's the end of the week. It's not too late, so you can get to work in the morning. And it just feels always like a celebratory event more than anything else. And again, a really important part of the rich history of being a queer person in New York.
Now, I noticed in several places you use the word queer, which mm-hmm. I love because I can't relate to this whole LGBTQIAPW. You know, there's just too many letters in there. And it seems too divisive to me. But the word queer, and if I had to guess, I would guess that's where the Q came from. The whole concept of your bar seems to be about just being, you know, unabashedly, unashamedly queer. You're not some bar that's trying to say, hey, we're gay on Tuesday, or we're going to, you know, welcome gay people, but we're really, you know, like a TGI Fridays. You're really trying to embrace the entirety of the community. And another quote that you had thrown out there in the press was, quote, celebrating the queer spectrum in all of its non-binary flow. And that kind of embraces, at least to me, what I'm feeling from you about what to expect at the Q.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. It's really important to me. It's always sort of being a Asian American, gay, queer creature, or whatever I feel, has always been an innate part of the reflection of my art that I create, and the art being creating experiences. And those experiences are for my New York and the New Yorkers that I see and share this amazing island with, and Brooklyn and Queens and everything else surrounding this island, New York. And that is white, black, brown, queer, trans, femme, mask, all of those things. That's just what New York looks like to me and feels like to me. And I think we all kind of came together to experience that. At least I hope so. So if I could foster that idea and nurture that idea, then I've done my job. And that, if that's my job, then it's nothing but an honor. So it was important for me to have this huge high-profile project, which is the venue, it's Q, to really just create a home for that entire idea. And I think we're going to do that for years to come. At least I hope so.
I certainly hope so. You know, we talked for a second about Billy Porter and his flamboyant costumes, but I stumbled across quite a few pictures of you with some pretty flamboyant outfits on yourself, lots of ruffles and feathers and crazy stuff. Should we expect to see more of that from you at the club?
I'm a community builder and I'm a showman. And I think those, and the pageantry of all of that does not scare me. And it's certainly, I only feel most comfortable when I feel seen for some reason. And I don't know what that is. But, and it's interesting because me and Billy are birds of a feather in that regard. And that's probably why we get along so well. And it is a sort of non-binary approach to the world in all of its splendor. And I think in my exterior, I represent that, but I don't think about it too much. It kind of just happens. So yeah, I think you can expect that a great deal. That's just who I am.
So the two of you together are kind of like the 21st century version of Liberace and Elton John.
I'll take that for sure.
In a totally queer environment. I mean, sure. You know, there are no limits. There's no rules. It's all about making the statement and embracing the mood that you're in that particular moment.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Now, I have a cousin named James who lives just a few blocks away from Q. Mm-hmm. And when I was talking to him the other day, he said something that just immediately made me think of you. He said, quote, "I am hoping for a big resurgence of old style New York debauchery." Mm-hmm. Even before you opened the doors to the Q, it has been described as the most exciting club New York City has seen since Studio 54. Is it going to live up to that expectation?
God, why does that always, that just made me so emotional. Yes, I hope so. I mean, if everything goes right, really, if the whole building is painted on time and all of the fixtures are up and the speakers are working and all of the actual operational stuff of the building construction is up, then the rest of my job, which is essentially already done, is injecting all of the artist talent and family members that I've put together over the last decade into that room. And by just doing that simple move, then I think we'll be creating that world for everybody. And I think I'm not really sure how to verbalize this, but you know, we didn't think this was gonna happen a year and a half ago when the pandemic happened. And we didn't even think our industry would return when the pandemic happened. But now that we're seeing not even a light at the end of the tunnel, the world is coming back and they've been at home for a year and a half. And I think everyone, and I've said these words before, but everyone's ready for this brave new world. And I think everyone's ready to celebrate with each other in this brave new world. And that's what the Q, I think, is going to be. At least I'm hoping it's going to be. So yeah, I think it's going to be a bonkers time for a while.
I certainly hope so. And, you know, I thought it was unfortunate that some people had equated the Q to Studio 54 because Studio 54 only lasted a few years.
Yeah.
It made a huge impact. I mean, everybody knows about Studio 54 and, you know, who knows how many movies have been made and how many knockoff T-shirts and everything else have existed. But it really was only around for like, 3 years? It wasn't very long.
Not long at all.
And we certainly hope that Q will stay there forever.
Well, we have a very long lease, so I hope we're there for the whole time. But yeah,
and it's a very bold venture because, like, as I said earlier, over the last 18 months or so, clubs have been closing down. Clubs that have been around for 30 or 40 years. I know New York. You lost Flaming Saddles in New York. There's several big clubs like Oil Can Harry's and Rage and so on in LA that have closed that were there for decades. And in about 7 or 8 months ago, people were starting to feel like, as you said, you know, the gay nightlife scene and maybe the nightlife scene in general was going down the tubes because of all the restrictions and they couldn't open. There was no revenue and they were closing down. But a project like this that you're taking not a little neighborhood hole in the wall and saying, hey, we're opening a new gay bar. You're doing a mega club. I mean, a four-story club that has a cabaret, a gentleman's club, a huge dance floor with high ceilings, you know, dancers, dining. You have a restaurant there, too, that you're going to be serving bar food, I guess, and...
Yeah, we have a full kitchen. Well, I think our full kitchen will be a kind of day two thing, seeing how that's going to work out. We're definitely going to do brunches on the weekend and late night bites on the first and second floor. That's going to all come into motion after we get through this weekend. But we're certainly going to be using our kitchen for sure. Well, we've got our plate full. Again, no pun intended. But yeah.
But that definitely. Yeah,
We got a lot to do, and there's a lot there. But like I said, I'm a showman, I'm an eccentric, and I'm ready for it all. And I actually only operate when I'm firing off on all cylinders. If I'm not, that's when I start to worry. If I'm too idle, I don't feel in my element. So all of these things, all of these layers, that's what makes me happy.
What we really like to see is you have such great success there that everybody around the country is talking about it. And within a couple of years, there's a queue that pops up in, I don't know, South Beach or LA, you know, maybe bring the New York vibe to another city so that people who don't get to New York very often can experience it too. I mean, Limelight did that successfully. They had numerous locations and I could see that happening with Q and with the team that you have, you know, to work with there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I have plans. I have plans. I think, you know, I'm going to see how this works. And if it works like I think it's going to work, I think this might be the first one in a foray into many. And I don't know many cues, but certainly many ideas of venues and spaces that I'd love to create for my community and beyond my community.
Or maybe you could just call each of them a different letter of the alphabet.
Love that. That actually makes my job super easy, too.
We have X in LA, and we have Z in Miami, and we have R in Chicago.
Yeah. I think that's amazing. Sounds like a really good idea.
Now, one of the things that over the years that you've been noted for is your extreme hair color. Right now, I can tell it's kind of like a dark bluish green or...
Yeah, it used to be blue, and now it's washing out, so now it's a sort of aqua. But I usually actually dye it maybe every couple of weeks, but I've been so busy. You can see the roots already, and I haven't been able to bleach it and dye it. But I think it's time to dive back in, maybe this weekend. I think this weekend I might have a free hour so I can dedicate that to my hair, but I really have no time to do anything. But yeah, my hair always changes.
Well, if you really want to be the personification of Q for the grand opening party, you probably want to have your hair be hot pink.
That is a very, very, very good idea. And weirdly, I did do pink. I was going to say, I've never done pink before. I recently did pink. We were actually talking about all of the management team or maybe the bar staff just doing a spectrum of the rainbow and all of us dye our hair. So we'll see about that. We'll see how much bandwidth we have to do all that.
Right.
Pink's a good idea. Pink's always a good idea.
But it's so exciting. It gives so much hope for the future that if, you know, a few people like you and Alan and Bob can get together and decide to undertake a venture of this magnitude while everything else seems to be going down the tubes, and to bring it to fruition right around the time when things are going to be opening again. I mean, it's almost like the stars were aligned for you. And now that everybody's starting to come out and able to go, you know, out to clubs and out in public, and a lot of people have been vaccinated, so it's a safer environment, because that would have been tragic if everybody had to wear masks. Although I'm sure you would have come up with some really crazy masks.
Yeah, we would have. I mean, I certainly have some in my closet now. But it was really, really important for us collectively as partners to decide that we wanted to be the return from all of our trauma. And we wanted, we actually are opening quite sooner than we thought we were going to, because we didn't anticipate how quickly the vaccination rollout would be, nor did we anticipate how eager and apt everyone would be. I guess we know New Yorkers take care of business always, and they want to see people and go out again and have their lives back. But I really thought we were going to open sometime in the fall, maybe even in the winter, when things eased back. And I just thought it would take longer to do so. But here we are. It's pretty amazing. And so the entrance to the queue for now is going to be vaccination card or proof of vaccination, so everyone inside feels safer. I didn't want to open the club and have people 6 feet away from each other wearing a mask. It just wouldn't have. I didn't want to perpetuate this whole traumatic year and a half. So I'm very fortunate of where we are. It really is like the stars are aligned, and like this entire project from the beginning, from Alan's first phone call, everything that has lined up has been very cosmic and very beautiful, including everyone involved and all of the performers and all the DJs and all of our investors and all of my friends. And the support has been immense. And I realize I'm going on a tangent now, but the amount of support that I have received in messages and DMs and emails and phone calls and text messages from people that I haven't even heard of in a very long time has been very shocking and wildly comforting to my system. Because as much as I see people all the time, when you're creating something, even with partnerships, it's very lonely out there. Because it's you and your thoughts and the want to be understood. So when people put the effort to understand you, I think that's the meaning of everything.
Yeah, and your sincerity shows through your, not only your words, but your actions. Everything that I've read and seen about your past accomplishments, about what you're doing with Q, it's not just fluff. It's not just saying, yeah, we want everybody to be there because that means more money. It's, you know, a sincere desire to create that community and have a safe space where everybody that identifies in any way as queer, non-binary, transgender, gay, whatever, can feel welcome and can have a place that is designed for them. You know, you're not forcing everybody to go to a drag show or everybody to go to a dance floor. You're giving them options all under one roof. Mm-hmm. And you've got an incredible group of people working with you between your partners and your investors. It's just amazing to see this all come together like that. And yeah, I wish I could be up there for whenever you actually do open, but I'm sure I'll get there eventually. Are you at liberty to say when you plan to open?
Yes, we will announce tomorrow. Wait, let me think about this, because I just came from a meeting thinking about when we were going to do this. So by this weekend, we shall be releasing our first round of tickets for Pride Weekend. And the first event publicly will be Friday the 25th through the weekend, and we'll be open from there.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So for New York City Pride Weekend, there will be some action at the queue.
That's right.
All right, then. We will be looking forward to that. I'm sure it'll make the news. I'm sure we'll be seeing it. You know, all these publications have already talked to you, people like, you know, Queerty and the Village Voice and everybody else. And I'm sure they're going to be there again for the opening. So I'm looking forward to seeing that. And then next time I get up to Manhattan, I'll have to come and check it out in person.
Please. Yes, please. We'll take such good care of you. We would love that.
Well, thank you. And thank you for taking the time to tell us not only about Q, but to tell us about your history in the club scene and about Mr. Black, which I had never heard about before. And that concludes another segment of the Gabe Archives podcast. You can find more podcasts at gabearchives.com/podcast. We also have more information about this podcast and links to the other podcasts we have completed. We hope you enjoy your trip down memory lane.